Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, hear from three accomplished writers who blend suspense with humor to tell compelling stories. This program was part of the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7th, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our next program here at the American Writers Festival. My name is Sydney, and I'm the Systems Operations Coordinator here at the museum, and I'm so excited to announce our next writers. You may have wondered, how do humor and suspense intersect to create compelling novels? These three funny masters of mystery discuss their latest works: Escape by Stephen Fishbach, A Murder Most Camp by Nicholas DiDomizio, and My Name Was Jerry Sass by Tiffany Hansen. Interviewing them is Erica Floyd, founder and owner of Lake Literary Center, a literary arts hub in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. A former magazine editor-in-chief and marketing director, her writing appears in Electric Literature, The Rumpus, Lunch Ticket, Business Week, and nonfiction books. Please join me in welcoming these writers to the stage.
Oh, you're all sitting in alphabetical order by last name.
As intended.
Okay, that's how I planned the questions, so this is going to be great.
Perfect.
Excellent. Thank you all for coming. We were just talking about how I'm not naturally funny, so hopefully these guests will do their best to supplement. There are so many dark and funny moments in these books. I loved each of them singularly, especially character development and voice. Many of these choices subvert expectations, they cut the tension, or they destroy a safe haven that the character previously relied upon, or a safe character that the characters previously relied upon. So I'm just wondering, you know, just to start us off, how did each of you decide when exactly a scene or a chapter needed some levity?
I guess we can go down the line. So hi, everybody. I'm Nick DiDomizio. My book is A Murder Most Camp, and it is about a 29-year-old Nepo baby who gets sent off to volunteer with his 12-year-old aunt at a summer camp where they stumble upon a decades-old murder, and all kinds of crazy shit happens from there. And I love this question because for me, I think the moments of levity are kind of like my starting point always. Like even this book, my other three books that I've published, everything that I've written that hasn't been published, I'm always kind of starting from a place of like, let me just make some jokes and like find a voice that's like fun to read and funny to read. Because those are the books that made me fall in love with reading. Very big on like a David Sedaris collection or even like a Chelsea Handler in college. Like, she was my favorite. I just saw her last week on her High and Mighty tour. Highly recommend if she is coming to your town. But yeah, so I always start from humor, and then thankfully when you do that, or luckily so far in my experience, like some of those stupid jokes can kind of then evolve into like real character or suspense or whatever. Like, for instance, giving my very, very rich protagonist a 12-year-old aunt, like that was just a joke at first because I'm like, okay, he's rich. He's going to have an 80-year-old grandfather who's on Cialis, who's married to a 30-year-old supermodel, and then they're going to have a 12-year-old. She's going to be his aunt. But then when you actually turn that into a character, it's like there's actually a lot of meat there that you can use to be like, well, how does that feel for her? You know, or, you know, and that kind of thing. So yeah, for me, I would say the levity is the first thing.
Hey, I'm Stephen Fishbach. My novel, Escape, with an exclamation point. So please, if you refer to it, you say Escape. It's not Escape. Yeah. Is about a reality television producer who sort of faces off on a jungle reality show against a has-been 40-something former reality TV contestant. I myself am also a has-been 40-something former reality TV contestant, but it is not autobiographical. My fictional contestant won his show, and I lost. So I mean, like Nick, I would say I think I start with humor first. Like, when I first wrote a draft of this book, I like really like plotted it out and structured it and slogged through all the things that I felt like was like a written novel was supposed to have. Like, here was a scene description and here was a plot point. And it felt like painful to write in a way, which I'd heard was kind of, you know, writing was painful. So that felt, I guess that was how it was supposed to feel. And then I actually watched this documentary with Philip Roth, and he was talking about how he ended up...
Notably funny guy.
Yeah, well, truly, like, hilarious. I mean, yeah. Wrote Portnoy's Complaint, and he was also sort of like slogging through this miserable book, and he said, you know, but I'm funny in real life, and like when I'm with my friends, I, like, we all try to like perform and entertain each other, and so like, why don't I try to do that on the page? So I had this sort of same idea, like, why don't I try to do that on the page? So I would just kind of, I guess, sort of what you like Nick was saying, like, try to like write something that entertained me on the page, and then kind of like layer in, you know, after I had a scene that I liked, like kind of like layered into this, you know, miserable structure that I had already created.
The structure Escape. Is not Escape. Miserable. And I wouldn't call you a loser of Survivor. You made it pretty
far. You're one of the few, or one of the only. Yeah.
Hi, I think it's obvious at this point that I'm Tiffany. and my book is My Name Was Jerry Sass. It's about a radio station owner who is a hitman. It's very, 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 very loosely based on my own father. And it's about, in the first chapter, not giving anything away, Jerry is murdered and spends the rest of the book in purgatory. And then his daughter goes on a sort of revenge tour, and his best friend who witnessed his murder is a Catholic priest by the name of Father Dan. And I would say for me, the humor doesn't come in a situation. It comes in the voice of the person I've created. In other words, I've had friends say to me, they read the book and they hear me. And so it's a kind of snarkiness. It's a tone that the characters themselves have, as opposed to a situationally funny thing that happens. And I think that more often than not, I don't think about where to add it, because I am so, in life, I am so snarky and sort of dry sense of humor anyway, that what I end up having to do is kind of dial it down. And so I will, to preserve some forward motion or some kind of, you know, propulsion or attention in a scene, whereas my brain will say, it would be really funny if this thing happened, I usually end up having to dial that back. And it usually, that thing comes in the form of like a comment made by one of the characters, or something they say in conversation with, or in their own head, a thought in their own head. And so I think for me, it's more about throttling that to a point that the characters are, you know, believable. Because we, you know, if they're funny naturally, some of that's going to come out. And I would say, you know, humor is about balance more than anything.
That's a great point. And I think it kind of leads to one of my next questions, which is that, is there a point when you can take humor too far in a suspenseful situation? How do you know when to dial it back? Throughout all three of these books, there are moments of violence, there are deaths, specifically murders in all three cases. So I just really think that in terms of those choices, being sensitive to your reader, but also cognizant of the fact that you want to insert these moments of humorousness, you know, how do you decide what's too much?
Yeah, I think this is an eternal struggle for me, because similarly, I'm always just like going for the most over the top, like, what's the best joke? In my earlier books, I would like fight for a scene, or I would fight against an edit purely to save a joke that I thought was good, even though the joke had like nothing to do with anything besides the joke itself. So that was kind of a learning curve. I definitely learned how to dial things back gradually by really focusing on the character and making sure that decisions that they made, the kind of ripple effect of everything they get themselves into, and the jokes that they do make, or the comedic situations that they do get in, are springing from something within the character, not just happening for the sake of like a punchline. That said, writing A Murder Most Camp was really liberating for me because camp is right there in the title. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to give myself permission to just be ridiculous a lot of the time and not take it too seriously. So it's a very self-aware kind of satirical, but still, there's still like a character arc. But with this one in particular, I leaned into some of the more over-the-top stuff as the story kind of went along and got more and more unhinged.
And the dialogue, I would say, is really good banter in this book. If you have not read it, can I actually just see a show of hands? Has anybody read the three books we're talking about? Or are you currently reading them? Okay, we will not be giving out spoilers then.
No spoilers. Great.
Okay, Stephen.
For me, I think it really is all about alternation, you know, making sure that, you know, the funny scenes and the suspenseful scenes are different scenes. I read this amazing craft book called Thrill Me by Ben Percy, and he looks at both genre novels and literary novels and kind of tries to like distill some like really great advice to like writing a great, exciting book. I would highly recommend it if any of you guys are aspirational writers or you know, current writers. It's a fantastic book. Maybe the best craft book I've ever read. But so I would try to like have comic scenes and then suspenseful scenes. And I think the alternation of those like enable them to sort of like exist on their own. I mean, I guess maybe this is in some ways related to what you said, but for like character moments, you know, when there was sort of like an opportunity to go deeper into a character, I think like something that's really, for me, it's really funny when you kind of play it really straight. So like on my cork board, I have like a post-it note that says like, for humor, take things too seriously. I don't know where that came from, but like I found it probably in some book I read. And I find that like that is really, has been true for me. And I actually really felt that reading My Name Was Jerry Sass, like Father Dan, like there's his like, almost how pathetic he is. Like there's something really funny about it, you know, but it's not played for laughs from his perspective, but right. Like because it's like so played straight, there's something like hilarious about like how overwhelmingly like that he is.
Thank you. I think for me, the dial, we're talking about the dial, right? Like when, and I think that I have learned over this process that my instinct may be to put a funny, snarky comment in or to have some funny dialogue, but I can instantly tell when it takes the air out of the room and out of the scene in a way that whatever forward motion I had is now gone because it's just all petered out from doing this one joke or not even a joke. I don't really have jokes. I have more like, you know, dark kind of really, really dark humor. My brain is a very strange place to be. It's very dark in there. So I would say it's very easy, I think, then to see where the gas just goes completely out of the scene. And so for me, it's about noticing those moments when the tendency might be to add something and then take it back. I had an interesting conversation with an aspiring writer at some point who asked me, he wanted to be more funny in what he was doing. And I said, and he was really struggling. It wasn't that he was a humorless person, but he just didn't know how to bring it to the page. And so what I suggested he do is write the most over-the-top version of whatever scene it was that he was thinking about, like the absolute sort of Mel Brooks version, Spaceballs version, and now unwind it so that eventually what you're left with are the bits and pieces that actually keep the integrity of the scene in the way you intended while also preserving some of the humor.
That's excellent writing advice, too. I think just knowing when the gas has gone out of a scene. And I think all of the writers in the room can relate, Nick, to fighting with their editors to not kill their darlings, especially the funny ones. You want to keep all of those.
Right.
So I totally understand that. And then, Tiffany, I'm just kind of, well, just to give you a little bit of an overview of My Name is Jerry Sass. My name was Jerry Sass. It is told from three points of view. So it is from Jerry Sass's point of view, who is the hitman with the heart of gold. It's told from Early's point of view, who is his daughter, and she's sort of a badass misanthrope. with literary aspirations.
Ooh, I'm going to steal that. Yeah.
Yeah, she really is. And Father Dan, who is a quietly rebellious priest, I'd say, with mob family ties. And each of these characters makes, frankly, shocking and violent decisions throughout the book in order to protect those that they love. So one of my favorite moments is when Early steals her father's Mustang after he's been killed and tails his murderers. And she's getting a little drunk and high along the way because, you know, she's 20. And she also doesn't have any shoes on. So these character choices are just really funny. And she's trying to get into a locked glove box to see what's in it. And she has no shoes on. I'm just wondering, why did you decide for her to not have any shoes on in that scene?
Well, okay, this is a very unfunny answer, though. Are you prepared for that?
I'm prepared.
Okay. So I studied a lot about trauma and the reactions that people have to trauma, because Jerry's life is very traumatic, and a lot of what he exposes the people in his life to is very traumatic. And one of the things that they tell you to do to kind of cope with a panic situation is to take your shoes off and feel the earth. And at a certain point when she's in the car and she's losing her fucking mind, sorry, are there kids here? Sorry. She takes her shoes off to feel the earth. And then the natural reaction to that is, or not reaction, but the, you know, as you spool that out, then you get to this point where she needs to take off. Shit's happening. She needs to get in that glove box, and she doesn't have time to put her shoes back on. And so here we are. And so I think for me, some of the fun of that situation is that I've set this up way back here. It's set up and payoff for me a lot of times. Like, you might not know that this thing I said back here is going to be funny, but it will be funny over here later because, oh, I get it. Oh, that's funny.
It
so,
is.
I mean, it's that walking the line. I mean, I'm talking about a traumatic response to a traumatic experience, and yet it's kind of funny.
It is. That dark humor is exactly what you were talking about before. It is kind of the moment when we realize that Early is all alone in the world, and she's sort of, you know, at her own BS. She has choices to make, but one of the choices that she makes is to take her shoes off. Nick.
Hello.
One of my favorite scenes, one of the funniest moments, I think, in A Murder Mouse Camp is when Mikey, who is the protagonist, decides to go back to a diner where they had been essentially interrogating the owner about this murder that happened 13 years ago. One of the campers that he's supervising loses her lip gloss. He goes back to retrieve it. He tries to hide from the owner, but he's like hiding in the order up window, like on the floor. He just doesn't have a lot of, I'd say like skills, survivor skills. He has no survivor skills.
Oh, yeah.
These character choices are really funny. And then at one point, someone steals the cabin air conditioner, which is basically the only thing keeping him alive, clearly.
Oh, yeah.
The physical comedy here is really funny. And how did you decide to make those choices?
I'm so glad you brought up the lip gloss / diner situation. So this was an interesting experiment for me, this book, because my last three books were all very much inspired by real experiences of mine. Before I wrote fiction, I was really into memoir and personal essays. Wrote a memoir at 24, and no agent wanted to represent it for a multitude of reasons, but I would imagine the fact that I was 24 had something to do with it. And so yeah, my first three books were like very, like the protagonists were not me, but they were certainly inspired by qualities of mine, and they were going through experiences that I have been through. Whereas this book was my first time writing a protagonist that I have very little in common with. He is, you know, the heir to a superstore fortune, and he spent his entire life just completely insulated from any type of discomfort whatsoever, to the point where, like, when he's cut off in the beginning of the book, and, like, he only has enough money to, like, get dinner at Panera, it triggers like a full existential meltdown because the thought of dining in a Panera and having to like hold a buzzer for the food and then like give the buzzer back and get like a tray of food, just the whole thing, I was like, I can imagine someone with his life would find this just absolutely appalling. So that just set me up for so many fun moments throughout the book. And then, of course, sending him to like volunteer at a ramshackle summer camp. The whole reason behind it is because he, the terms of his trust are changed and his family finally decides, like, you need to at least do one good thing for humanity before you can get your full inheritance, or else we're really just, we've created a monster. So the reason he's at this camp is to kind of get these uncomfortable experiences, but he has no tools kit for anything, and so it was an initial joke that like was able to just pay rewards throughout the book. But just a little side note on the diner situation, so the diner in the book is called Mama Moo's Roadside Cafe. And it was so fun to write her as a character and that whole thing, because the one part of this book that was inspired by real life is that I was at my friend's house in Connecticut one weekend a couple summers ago. We were all very hungover, and I was like, where can we get a good breakfast sandwich around here? And they took my partner and I to a place called the Country Cow Deli. And so then like a few months later, we're at their house and we wake up, we're hungover again. I'm like, you know what I would really love? One of those sandwiches from, what was it? Mama Moo's Cafe. And they were like, who is Mama Moo? Like, it's called Country Cow Deli. But that, for some reason, my brain turned it into Mama Moo. And then like throughout that day, like the four of us just started talking about if there was a Mama Moo, like who would this person be and what kind of operation would she run? And so I kind of just threw that into the book because it was just fun.
I love that. That's how Mama Moo's was born, out of a hangover.
Mama Moo's was born out of a hangover, and my friend Matt, I had to thank him in the acknowledgments because he was the one who coined her catchphrase, the best bacon, egg, and cheese this side of the Tappan Zee.
Fantastic.
So shout out to Matt Lipton.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen. So there's this climactic scene in Escape.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. In which the shrewd producer Beck, who I would say is probably the hero of the story.
That's amazing. I think of her as the villain of the story. That's so great. I love that you call her the hero of the story.
I
love that. Okay.
And then the aging outdoorsman, Kent, and this hapless 20-something Miriam come to blows. So there's this climactic scene. They're all fighting, essentially. There are some really interesting choices in this scene, particularly what each character grabs for in their time of need and their choice of weapon. And how did you make those choices?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, right, any object, obviously, in a book, you want to sort of imbue it with symbolic power. And honestly, writing a book on a jungle island makes that really easier in some ways, because there's so few objects that suddenly like anything that they have has just an inherent symbolic sort of like meaning to it. So on my fictional reality show lawyers Escape, each contestant gets an object that they get to start the game with. And so like inherently there's, and it's like assigned by the producers sort of, but inherently it's a characterizing thing. And it also is, you know, deeply like it matters to them. And I hope it is a comic way. So like Kent, who is this sort of like has been alpha male, is so proud that he gets to have the machete. He gets like the big sword, you know? And so that sort of like becomes representational of like his like sort of psychic desires throughout the thing. So of course in the climax, you know, I kind of want him to like have his like big alpha male sword. And then Beck, who is this producer, villain, hero, you know, TBD, you the reader decide. But she has been sort of, you know, using her camera kind of to manipulate the contestants, you know, and sort of through the lens of the camera is kind of like forcing them into these story arcs that she sort of has pre-planned for them. So I really like the idea that like, you know, when the shit hits the fan, like she literally is grabbing for a camera to like bludgeon them with, you know, not necessarily literally bludgeon them. I mean, and Miriam, you know, I don't want to like give away the whole book. You know, this is like 300 pages into this.
Spoilers.
Yeah. So I'll just leave it at that.
Miriam is such a great character, though. I truly love her. The character development in this book is so good. You should all read this book. Buy it. Buy all of these books.
Agreed.
Yeah, please do. Okay, so I would say, in terms of some more questions that I had, in the writing process, do you find that you write the major plot points first and then add in banter dialogue later? How do you inject humor into your writing process? You kind of touched on this already, but I'm just wondering if you have like a specific process that you go about.
This was an interesting one for me because I sold it on proposal to my publisher. So normally I would never outline a book. Like I would not really, like I would have an idea of maybe the shape of it, but normally I'm only thinking about the character and like what their voice is and like what types of things might like make this character go crazy and have be forced to like change. But this was very different because like once I signed the book deal, they made me like write an outline to show them that I had an idea of like what it was going to look like. So I did write out a bunch of beats and they completely changed as I was drafting, as I'm sure many people who have tried to outline it, I feel like it happens to all of us. But yeah, the banter and like the voice is just the main thing. So, and that was like, before I wrote the outline, I wrote the three sample chapters for the publisher. And that was what sold the book, I think, because the outline was just extremely basic. And a lot of it was like, insert clue here. So yeah, it was definitely like the banter and the voice and all of that actually sold the book. Cause it's the most fun to write. And I think it's the most essential to make it a story that people want to follow, regardless of what the plot ends up being.
I think you're the first person I've ever met who sold a novel on proposal. I've never heard of that. That's amazing.
It was only because I've been at the publisher for a couple books, so...
You had the inside scoop.
Yeah, they're really supportive, and so yeah, I don't think any other publisher would have done that for me, but...
How about you, Stephen?
So Escape is a book that's fundamentally all about storytelling. Like Beck, this producer, is trying to sort of craft these beautiful three-act narratives for the contestants. Meanwhile, the contestants themselves are kind of trying to seize control of their story. They want to be basically the authors of their own destiny, while the producers, you know, really want to author their destiny for them. So given that, I really felt like I had to structure this book quite like rigorously. So it did have a three-act structure where all of the sort of high points intermingle at the climax. So I wrote that structure, and then I kind of sort of built scenes. Like I kind of like hung, like decorated the Christmas tree. You know, like I hung scenes along that were hopefully funny. But I didn't really have suspense. Like I pitched this when I sent this out to editors. At publishing houses, I sort of pitched it as a literary novel with thriller bones, but my editor commented that the thriller bones were very weak. And so the lowest tier was the structure of the book, and then I kind of like layered humor on top of it, I added like suspense on top of that. Like there were specific scenes I added, like, you know, sort of like in your kind of like joke tea or like plot point decay, like it was like, you know, suspense decay. Like it was, so I added scenes that hopefully like added suspense and kind of like turned the dial on that aspect of it.
Once again, here I am not doing what anyone else does, which is I didn't outline anything, and I don't usually outline anything. What I describe it as when I'm writing, I see a light way off in the distance about where I want to be, and so I know where we're going, but I'm not sure how we're going to get there. And what I do when I'm writing is I feel like I'm sitting next to my character and I'm just writing what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're saying. And so it's really about, for me, it's about just following these people around. And so for me, a lot of it is a process of discovery about, as a, you know, it sort of becomes a question of logic, like what would they do next, what happens next, where are they going at a certain point. But it's very much like following these people around, and so the humor for me comes in just watching them do the, you know, react to the situations that they're in with the personalities that I've given them. that are nothing like me. I'm not going to kill anybody. I'm not going to kill anybody.
Never.
But you know, they're it's just a very observational way of writing that is less structured, and it's extremely unhelpful for most people, because a lot of people I know want to have an absolute outline about where they're going and who, you know, what their characters are doing. And I just don't.
Well, I think it's the age old plotter versus pantser question for writers, right? And I think, despite the fact that you appear to be a pantser, you know, you write by the seat of your pants, this is a really slim, taut novel. And I'd say, despite your best efforts, you still have a very clear three-act structure. All of these books do, in which all of the characters make really funny but conflicted choices. And I think it's so fun to basically, like you said, follow your characters around and watch them make self-destructive decisions. That's my favorite kind of book to read.
Do you know where it's going to end when you do that? Like, do you know kind of how those arcs are going to end if you're just kind of observing?
Not initially. So I'm a pantser.
Definitely.
Yeah. I did know, I did know where Jerry, I mean, Jerry's dead.
Yeah.
So.
That happens.
Not a
spoiler. I mean, I kind of got that figured out pretty quick. but I did know how, you know, his journey through purgatory is, as people who believe in that will tell you, is that it's a process of purification. According to Catholics, it's a process of purification where someone has to reconcile their past behavior in order to make it, presumably, to heaven. And so Jerry's chapters are each a moment, a slice of his life where he tries to reconcile what he did. Needless to say, he doesn't really feel like he needs to, because he's that kind of guy. But I did know, to answer your question, I did know where his arc was going to end up in terms of how we, the readers, and how they, the other two characters, process his death.
I really like Jerry's observations from Purgatory, too. Those are fascinating. He seems to still sort of have like a corporal sense of identity, almost. He's still sort of physically feeling things, which is funny in itself, because he's obviously not on the earth anymore. A couple more questions. So I'm curious, did the authors read each other's work before coming up here today?
I'm about a third of the way through each. And as my editor told me to say, I'm looking forward to finishing it.
I just finished My Name Was Jerry Sass on the plane over, which was incredible. I loved it. And I'm looking forward to reading Nick's book.
Yes. I was going to say, I'm the same, looking forward to finishing both. It's the past 6 weeks have been a whole...
Tell me about it.
...situation.
Yeah.
I mean, when isn't everything a situation? But it was... I usually do try to, no matter what type of event I'm doing, I do try to read the books, because it does make the event a little more... you know, interesting, but
it's
been a lot of events the past month.
Yeah. And it's nice to support each other. And
he was telling me before we started here that he has a pretty intense day job. So that kind of leads me to another question. Do all of you have day jobs besides writing? And do you take inspiration from your day jobs, especially funny situations, to incorporate into your writing?
I haven't, strangely enough. The book that I'm have coming out next year is probably the first time I'm exorcising a lot of day job frustration into one of my characters. I guess I have too in one of my past books. But yeah, it comes up just because it is such a huge part of life.
What is your day job?
Right now, I work in marketing for a big tech company, and we have a huge event coming up literally tomorrow. so that's been dominating my life for the while I've been on this book tour. So my therapist is
nice
involved in my life heavily at the moment.
Being well utilized.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't say I take any humor or funny moments from my day job, but I do have two small children, and so life with them is filled with both like tragic and funny moments, like pain and some great pain and suffering, and also some like lunacy and hilarity. So I try to like steal as much from their lives as I can.
How old?
That wasn't serious. I'm stealing from their lives. I'm turning them into art. They are 5 and 2.
Oh, that's those are fantastic ages, especially for humor.
Yeah.
You have to have a sense of humor when they're 5 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
I am a host on WNYC, which is the public radio station in New York City. Public radio fans, where are you? Yeah. WBEZ. Mm. I'm a pinch hitter on the air, and so you'll hear me hosting Morning Edition or hosting one of our talk shows or hosting anything that we do. And I have a long history in radio, in public radio and in radio, commercial radio as well, which is Jerry in the book owns a small AM country station, radio station in rural Iowa. I grew up in Iowa. And I think the parts of my day job that made it into the book are all related to having worked at some of those stations. I worked at a little AM station for a while in my 20s where I did the newscasting. And I was that little darling in the morning. God help me. And but it was a station that was family owned. And they just don't exist much anymore, those stations. So much has been swallowed up by Clear Channel. And, lots of other evil media conglomerates. And so it was fun to go back and kind of relive. And there's a lot of humor in those places, believe me.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
A small...
Commercial radio is a cesspool. Anyway, yeah. So... that alone, and then you kind of downsize it, it distills into a tiny little petri dish of craziness.
I bet. I have a day job too. I own a farm, and part of what I do a couple days a week is I deliver mushrooms for our farm, and I could write a book alone on the back end of grocery stores and restaurants.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I think it's fascinating. It has nothing to do with what I do for creative writing, but I just think it's such a good contrast to that. So thanks for sharing all of your day jobs, your ordinary lives.
I will say that if you want to find a source or wealth of insane antique characters, you really can't do better than going on reality television. So,
yeah, absolutely. Are you going to go back?
No.
Have you been asked this before?
Yeah, but except for the Traitors. Obviously, everyone would do the Traitors.
Of course. Okay, favorite funny writers. Who are your inspirations?
Oh gosh, there's so many. One of my favorite books ever is a book called How to Murder Your Life by Kat Marnell. I don't know if anybody has read that. It's a very fucked up addiction memoir that explores some very dark themes, but she is so good at telling a story and being hilarious while she does it. She has a new book. Her first novel is coming out, I think, next year. It's called The Bored and the Beautiful, and I just cannot wait. So she's up there for me, even though it's only one book. but Chelsea, like I said before, just for a reliable, good time, love a David Sedaris moment. Jenny Lawson has some really fun books that I like. I'm still getting into, fiction is, strangely enough, even though I write fiction, it's not usually comedy that I'm reading.
Yeah.
Usually for if I want to laugh, I'm reading something in the nonfiction realm.
For me, I'm going to go with one really old school, which is Charles Dickens, who I think is hilarious, but also great at combining comedy with suspense and sort of drama. And he also, I was talking earlier about alternating kind of comedic and suspenseful beats, and I think he's kind of the king of that, where, you know, in one scene you'll have these like two guys having lunch for like 30 pages and it's the funniest lunch you've ever read, and then the next scene like someone's getting murdered in a boat, and it's the most thrilling murder you've ever read. So he's great in terms of just that alternation and keeping like the plot momentum while you're having these sort of ridiculous sort of daily life scenes. And a more contemporary writer is Lior Torenberg, who just wrote this book Just Watch Me and came out a couple months ago, and it's about this young girl who starts to sort of live stream her life, and you know, into, of course, like, you know, calamity ensues. But it's great, it's funny, and it feels very current.
I mean, I don't, like you, I don't read a lot of fiction. Honestly, I do end up reading a lot of nonfiction. I do it primarily because I don't want to tarnish my own voice. And so I find myself pretty much exclusively gravitating toward nonfiction. Like, I just went back recently and reread everything that Ian Frazier ever wrote, because that is a worthwhile pursuit to do that. He's fantastic. And he just wrote a book about the Bronx that was phenomenal. And I also tend to find humor in, when I do read, on the rare occasions when I do read fiction, I tend to find humor in books that aren't necessarily marketed as such. Because I have such a dark sense of humor. For example, Augustine Burroughs wrote a book called Dry.
Love that book.
That book has changed my life, that book. That book is an amazing, amazing, often funny, often tragic exploration of getting sober. And also tragedy. It's just, and the thing that he does, which is I think why I love it, which is I think why you'll see elements of that in my characters, is that even the most fucked up situations are sometimes funny, or something funny will happen, or you'll have a funny thought, even in tragedy, because it's how we cope. This is how we get through this thing. And so, yeah, I would say probably that's the best I'm going to do when it comes to funny writers.
Well, I think now we all have a reading list, which is very helpful. I also read a lot of nonfiction for funny writing. New Yorker, Shouts and Murmurs, McSweeney's, all of those. I would say they probably all qualify as nonfiction. And the world is such a scary and weird place right now that sometimes just reading journalism is also funny.
As a journalist, I can appreciate that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any questions from the audience that we can open it up to? Yes, go ahead.
How hard was it to initially get published?
Good question.
How much time have you got? You know, publishing is a weird world that changes the rules on you all the time. And the way things are, at least as I understand them right now, a lot of what it takes to get published is to have a great agent, because your agent is doing a lot of that, especially with somebody like me on a debut novel. Your agent is doing a lot of your editing with you, so that when you send it out, it's in the best possible position you can get it to, so that when it does get in the hands of an editor. So you have this long runway of process first. And then, you know, some folks do that and then they're trying to get an agent. I mean, it's like dog eat dog. And it's soul crushing. And also like some of the biggest highs you can get. So it takes forever.
I always refer to publishing as institutionalized gambling.
Yes.
Because it really is. Your version of like putting money on the table is like your sweat and your time and all of your best ideas into a manuscript. And then you can't control whether an agent is going to want it. And then if an agent does want it, if a publisher is going to want it. And then once you are published, Murder Most Camp is my fourth book. So like my first book, I got the gambling high of when it was picked up by Little Brown and like James Patterson did a glowing cover blurb, and it was like, oh, this is going to be great. But then commercially it flopped. So then it's like, you know, selling the next book becomes, you become judged on those sales numbers. And so again, you have to like hope that luck strikes at the right time. At the and at a certain point, it like the quality of the work starts to matter less. Not to be depressing on a comedy panel.
Could we be more depressing in a humor panel? Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, but, you know, perseverance is always a good thing. And really, when there are people in the industry, like, who believe in your voice and, like, how we were talking about, like, this book sold on proposal, it was really just because, like, I had an editor at Sourcebooks who said, like, I know your sales suck, and this is going to be really hard to get past our acquisitions team and our publisher and everything, but I want you to be in print, and I know how bad you want it. So, like, if you get these advocates inside the industry, like, you can get many chances. So, you know.
Yeah.
One thing that I did, maybe that's, like, practical and useful for someone who is trying to get published, is, like, you know, the agent is going to be, they're going to read, like, the first sentence or first, you know, second or first paragraph of your query letter, but, you know, before they read on to the second, hopefully read on to the second paragraph. So I wanted to, like, get as many credentials that were meaningful to them as I possibly could. So, like, I went to Breadloaf, which is a writer's conference, you know, so I could write, I go, okay, he went to Breadloaf. I started submitting short stories, you know, so, okay, he was published in this periodical. So, like, suddenly there was, like, some kind of, like, credential that, like, the agent could latch onto, like, oh, this person has put in the work, he's done things, and other people have read his stuff. So I would, like, really recommend that, like, before going out on submission necessarily for your first book.
Yeah, get some traction. Yeah. Definitely. That helps. Any other last questions? Yep, go ahead.
I don't know how much time we have for it, but I would love to hear a little bit about suspense, because I think that both, and I've heard that both humor and suspense come from a similar point of you want to hook people in, build and build and build, and then release. And I would love to hear a talk about, like, how do you build that tension and how you know when to hit the button and release?
Great question.
Yeah, let me, I know, right? I'm like, oh, what happened to you going first? Yeah.
My answer was literally going to be like, well, you have to build tension and then release it.
I think it's like one thing you do is like you ask questions, right? You sort of like create moments that are inherently going to say like the person's going to say, like, what is going on here? So I literally like because like I my thriller/suspense bones were weak. Like with the advice of my editor who has edited a lot of great thriller and suspense books, like I would add scenes that are literally like these two people are talking about something, but we don't know what's going on here, you know? So like kind of like that just sort of like build that suspense. And I had a payoff for it, but I wasn't adding the extra scene earlier that had the sort of like that asked the question really explicitly.
I would say I'm a little sneakier about my suspense. And so what I do is I take a very innocuous conversation and then I somebody dies. And so it's like the suspense is throughout the novel that way because it's like, oh shit, like any moment. You know, some very innocuous conversation could end with somebody who has an air compressor nozzle in their eyeball.
Or who unexpectedly ends up cremated. So.
Right. Yeah. So it's more for me, it's less about building the scene suspense and more about that surprise creating a tension and a suspense overall.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all so much. This was such a delight.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much, Erica.
Really amazing questions.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.